is Building Bridges with Ken Nash and Mimi Rosenberg.
And later on, The Heritage, Black Athletes of Divided America and the Politics of Patriotism, featuring Harold Bryant, ESPN senior writer and NPR correspondent.
But first...
Did you see Jackie Robinson hit that ball? It went zooming across the left field wall.
Yeah,
Jackie hit that ball. He swung his bat and the crowd went wild, 'cause he hit that ball a solid mile. Oh, yeah, Jackie hit that ball. Oh, did you see Jackie Robinson hit that ball? Really hit it? Yeah, and that ain't all.
Oh, the song, but the song sung by Natalie Cole. And what a way of ushering in our guest. You know, it may make people uncomfortable, but I'm pleased that Howard Bryant has chosen to tell the story of our heritage, and even more pleased that there are still ball players today who are willing to stand up for what they think is right. And I certainly didn't say that, but Henry Aaron did, Major League Baseball Hall of Famer. And with that, I am absolutely excited, because I've been reading the book all weekend and I absolutely love it, to have with us the author of The Heritage, Black Athletes, A Divided America and the Politics of Patriotism, Howard Bryant, ESPN senior writer and NPR correspondent, and author of Shut Out, A Story of Race and Baseball in Boston, and The Last Hero, A Life of Henry Aaron. And this book is fantastic, The Heritage. Howard, thank you so much for joining us.
Amy, how are you doing? Thanks for having me.
Well, I'm excited to have you, but I'm gonna trick you a little bit. Well, not really. I want to. I mean, books are, whether they're proclaimed as such, autobiographical in a sense. And while you're talking about so many of the black athletes that we do need to know, and who took one road and why, and others took other roads, you know, there is a point of distinction between the Michael Jordans and the LeBron James and so on, and we'll talk more about that. But I want to talk about you. I want to talk about black broadcasters with places like ESPN. I couldn't help but think about Janele Hill, who mentioned the issue of white supremacy in the form of Trump over the issues that unfolded with the killings in Charlottesville, etc. So where do black sportscasters fit into this? What is their kind of trial and tribulation, and where do they continue the kind of legacy that has really always been before the black athlete, which was one of survival, one of some form of self-determination and recognition within a society, within their respective areas? Where do you fit into that, and how difficult is it for you to be a writer of such prominence in this arena?
Well, I think it's a great question, and I think that one of the areas that I try to talk about in Chapter 4, I think it was, is about that responsibility that we have and the pressure that African-Americans have once you reach a certain level of prominence where you are expected, especially if you're in the ballplayers area where you are transitioning from being probably intensely poor to becoming super rich. And that expectation of that money is that suddenly these issues don't apply to you anymore, and that you're not supposed to rock the boat. You're not supposed to talk about any of these things anymore because they don't apply to you directly because now you're rich. We keep talking about how the athlete is the only employee in the country that we want to hear less from the more money they make. we talk about Donald Trump being president. Why? Because he's rich. And Michael Bloomberg got to be the mayor of New York City. Why? Because he's rich. We talk about Mark Cuban and Oprah Winfrey being presidential candidates suddenly. Why? Because they're rich. But when you hear the black athlete talk, we say, shut up and play and be grateful. And what are you complaining about? Because you've got so much money. And the same is true for writers in a lot of ways, where there were so few, especially big city columnists, very few cities, with the exception of maybe Washington, D.C. and Detroit, some of those major black cities, have ever even had a mainstream leading black writer speak for the city. And the deal that came with those jobs, with those appointments, in a lot of ways, even though you were hired to provide a voice that they like to call diverse, is the pressure of not talking about race, because the public doesn't want to engage. They may not want to hear it. So you hear black writers say all the time, well, I don't want to be a black writer. I just want to be a writer. And what does that do to this heritage? What does this do to that responsibility, where a lot of the black athletes are counting finally once and for all and having a voice in media to represent you? And you're not willing to do that. So as much as we may want to criticize the Michael Jordans of the world for not getting involved, there is a generation of black writers who have gotten these prominent positions and immediately fled from that responsibility as well. Mm-hmm. And for me personally, to answer your question, Mimi, to me, I felt like when I was named a columnist at the Boston Herald, I'm the first and only African-American columnist in sports that paper's ever had to this day, and that paper's been around since the mid-1800s, my position was, they didn't give you this job to mimic everybody who has it. They gave you this job to write what you felt. So write what you feel. And if the price of writing what you feel is hate mail or vitriol or fewer opportunities in the future, well, then that's the price. If you're not going to be yourself, then what's the point of having the job? And so there's no question that this happens to every – it's not just the players. The pressure to essentially amputate the racial side of yourself because it makes the mainstream uncomfortable is something that virtually all black professionals have to deal with.
That's a heck of a word, amputate. Wow, to suffer that kind of bifurcation.
Well, it really is true, though. It's a word that – And it's an important word, and I want it to sound as harsh as it is. You are actually being asked to amputate a piece of yourself. We don't want you to be black. How many times? Think about the ways that we speak in language. Think about the words that are embedded and baked into our language. When I look at you, I don't see color. Well, what do you see? Why don't you get to see me? When we think about the Oscar Wildes of the world, do we separate his Irishness from his talent? When you read someone like Ernest Hemingway, do you separate that machismo and that alpha male from his writing? No, that was a part of his writing. That was his personality. We celebrated that part of the Hemingway swagger. We wanted that piece of it. But when you deal with African Americans, the more they climb, people say, well, what are you going to talk about race all the time for? Because it makes them uncomfortable. They don't want you to be yourself, because they can't handle what they see. And if you play along with that, then you're doing their work, in my opinion, and you're not being a part of this heritage. Because I remember very clearly 1993, I was 24 years old. I was in the San Francisco Giants locker room in spring training in Scottsdale, Arizona. And I remember Willie McGee, a veteran center fielder on the exercise cycle, riding the bike and he came up to me, he introduced himself to me, he told me to come over to him when he was on the bike, and he said, good to see you. And what he was saying was, and then he said it point blank, we need more of you. And what he was really saying was is that our position is not represented through the eyes of the mainstream media. And when you look at sports, the filter of sports is very clear. White owners, white coaches, white season ticket buyers, white media, black player. So everything about the game is written through that lens, is interpreted through that lens. And it's our responsibility in this business, whether you like it or whether you don't, to try and at least give a different perspective from some of these players. That's why it's important to have Latino writers in Major League Baseball that's 35% Latino, that's 35% Spanish speaking. At some point, you've got to have the filter has got to be apples to apples. If it's not, then the player is always going to feel diminished and always going to feel distorted. So you do have a responsibility, and that does come with some financial sacrifice. I always tell people that the types of books that I write are very different. They're not going to necessarily get you all the riches that you may think you want. If you don't want people to be mad at you, then go write an biography of Britney Spears or Beyonce or something. This is not that.
But the greatest rich, of course, is to continue to proclaim self-determination.
Well, absolutely. The work is the reward.
100%. So do you think it's, I have to say, as much as I love the various, sports and so on, I find it hard. I was thinking about this when Trump nonsensically said that he was thinking about pardoning Muhammad Ali, who, of course, his case had been set aside by the Supreme Court. Thank you for your
opportunity. He doesn't quite need your pardon.
And, of course, they would have crushed and did crush the system, did as much as they could, except for his dignity, his pride, and his sensitivities, which rose above it, which has always been.
Well, and one other very big thing, Mimi, that people mm-hmm. seem to forget when it comes to Muhammad Ali, it wasn't just his sensibility. It was also his talent. And the one thing I say about this heritage all the time is that it's not a club you want to join. You look at every person, look down the line. Paul Robeson was destroyed for his beliefs. People talk about Jackie Robinson. Jackie Robinson, you've got freeways and schools named after him, and he's on a stamp. When Jackie Robinson retired in 1956, Major League Baseball did not offer him a single job for the next 16 years of his life, or the remaining 16 years of his life. If you look at what Curt Flood did in terms of challenging baseball's financial system, he was blackballed. Look at John Carlos and Tommy Smith, same thing. They were blackballed for raising that black fist up at the 68 Olympics. All of these players, and of course, Muhammad Ali was sentenced to 5 years in prison and lost 3.5 mm-hmm. years of his career. But what's the difference between Muhammad and everybody else? He was good enough to win. He got his title back. He changed the narrative because he had the ability to win. Think about how we would talk about Muhammad today if he never got his title back, if he never had that second act. He was a champ again, and then you could celebrate him as a champ. Otherwise, you would look at him as a martyr, as somebody who was destroyed. Instead, he grew stronger. But the only reason he grew stronger was, one, because he was right. He was vindicated from Vietnam. And also because he could play. He won again. He was the champ again. You had to deal with him. If he didn't win, then the culture could have dismissed him.
Well, we are speaking with Howard Bryant, The Heritage, Black Athletes, A Divided America, and the Politics of Patriotism, beautifully written, no arcane language, digestible, etc. But I have to say that one of the things, as you kind of parsed out the individual, many of them, heroes and sheroes of myself, like the Tommy Smiths and the Robesons and the Alis and the John Carloses, etc., and LeBron James, very much for me, and of course, people like Colin Kaepernick, and could have been a couple of more women from the women's basketball league.
But, absolutely. Minnesota Lynx. Absolutely. Maya Moore and a lot of those players.
So I couldn't help but think in my mind, have we really come that far? These spectacular people who rose to the top of their dignity despite the outrageous slings and arrows of white supremacy, but that the actual venues, the arenas that they function in, still had this gladiatorial kind of feeling to them. And it did feel to me like, in terms of business and all the rest, that the black athlete is still very much chattel in a particular sense. And that's not to demean the individual. But the function of the owners' leagues and the kind of way they would rob the patriotism, the dignity, the speech, the freedom of expression from the black athlete, like they try to do with, of course, people like Ali, like they try to do with Tommy Smith, like they try to do with John Carlos, and like they are doing and have been successful now in doing with Colin Kaepernick. Is the arena very different, or do we really have to kind of break through and reconceptualize the whole ownership structure. Hey, is that something going to even be done in sports today? Doesn't that perpetuate the racism and the decapitation, the efforts to disarm the totality, the whole spirit and energy of black athletes?
It does. And I think that's one of the really interesting things when we talk about you brought up two interesting questions, two really good questions. One, is it enough? And this is one of the issues when I was thinking about this, the third part of this book. The book is segmented off into three sections. The first is the heritage, the beginning of it, the rise and fall. The second is War Games, which is this commentary on the flag and the patriotism post 9/11 that has permeated sports, that's been embedded into sports ever since September 11th. And then the third part is the awakening, which is the revival of these black athletes post Ferguson. And I began asking this question: do you get to join this heritage? Do you get to join the Jackie Robinsons and the Paul Robesons simply by wearing a T-shirt, simply by saying I can't breathe, simply by saying things when you have your corporate sponsor behind you being on the right side of the issue? So you get Nike to put together some slick ad campaign. But what did you actually risk? You've lost nothing. And you're not risking anything. Colin Kaepernick obviously risked plenty. But even in Colin Kaepernick's case, he risked millions, but he also had millions. So it's important to compare and contrast the origins of the heritage to today's corporate athlete. The other question is that perhaps we've reached a secondary stage in this where revolution and where protest is actually fought on a different front, and that is reducing the power of the owners and having more power for yourself. I think LeBron James is a phenomenal individual in this regard. I think that LeBron's endgame, when you look at him, despite the fact that he owns his own film company and that he's got percentages of all of these different companies and he's got endorsements and he's signed a $90 million contract with Nike when he was 18 years old before he'd even played his first game. For all of those things, and for despite his net worth of $450 million, LeBron James very clearly wants to undo this entire notion of the owner-player relationship. He believes in the game as a partnership, and you can hear him sort of hijack the game where he refers to owners by their first name, whereas we know that players always refer to the owners as Mr., even though they're grown men. They refer to Jerry Jones as Mr. Jones and Mr. Gilbert and Mr. Ricky back in the day. And I listen to this and I'm thinking to myself, in my own business, do I call my boss Mr.? I do not. LeBron James doesn't do that. He hijacks and embeds himself into the game. And he doesn't refer to the game as the owners. He says our game, which is a subtle way of letting the public know that we're not just chattel. And you can't just treat us like this, even though he makes $33 million a year. He doesn't have any power. He's trying to shift that narrative and create a new sort of dynamic where the players may one day actually choose the commissioner and they're not just disposable pieces to the sport. But that's going to require a redefinition of this revolution that we're talking about. Do players have what it takes? I had a wonderful conversation. I think it's chapter – they all roll into one now. I think it's chapter 8. Chapter 9 with Carmelo Anthony, who was playing for the New York Knicks at the time. And he was talking about Donald Sterling, when Donald Sterling was saying all those terrible things about Magic Johnson, and the players wanted to revolt, but the players trusted Adam Silver, the commissioner, to handle this. They threatened the boycott, but they trusted the commissioner, and the commissioner removed Donald Sterling from his ownership position with the Clippers, forced him to sell the team. And that wasn't good enough for Carmelo. Carmelo's point was no. We needed to show them right then and there that we weren't going to take this. We should have boycotted. We should have boycotted the playoffs, and we should have not played at all so they saw that we are the game. We had an opportunity right there, and instead we bought back in. So there is these different sort of kernels of dissidence that you have with these players. But Carmelo also said something else. He said two things. The first thing he said was, we all remember that their billions outweigh our millions. And we also remember that there are many, many of us that don't want to take the risk. We're very comfortable with somebody handing us a check for $10 million, and we're not going to upset that, even though by putting up a little bit of risk, we could have 20, 30, 40, 50 million or our own billions. We're not willing to risk that. Too many players are too comfortable.
You know, I was thinking, again, as you were talking, and by the way, I love the cover of the book, The Heritage, Black Athletes, A Divided America, and the Politics of Patriotism. It's a football helmet, and it's a black football helmet with a big red fist, the kind of red fist that we used to see on posters around Vietnam or from the Black Panther Party or various other places. But the trajectory of struggle, of African Americans, of African American athletes. It's always been there, and it's really been the most way of defining democracy, real democracy, not patriotism with, you know, a rhetorical sense, but the real patriotism and the patriotism of freedom, of self-determination, which is must be an inherent part of democracy. And I think that comes pouring through your book, and you're placing the athlete within the context of the struggles around Michael Brown and so much else. It is such a rich and important contextual piece. And, you know, I went back to people like who I really idolized at various points, like Jim Brown and the Bill Russells. They've been there. They've always been there. It's almost the exception in many ways that perhaps the vacillation or identity issues of a Tiger Woods may have vitiated the pivotal role of black struggle in the form of the black athletes. And, of course, athletics are the predominant and most important cultural expression and feature in this country. So I think you capture it and you take us and you give us an appreciation both of, the trials and tribulations, the enormity of the sacrifice. But in the final analysis, Kaepernick is the winner.
Yeah, I mean, no question. And it also depends on your definition of victory. But I think you're right. And I think that there have been many, many times when we fall for the trap of one, categorizing victory simply based on the number of zeros on your paycheck and not thinking about principles and not recognizing. You asked me earlier about the reaction and the responsibility that writers have, and the number of times, whenever I've taken on a project, the number of times someone has said to me, well, if you write this, you're going to, you know, your career is going to be over. When I wrote my steroid book, Juicing the Game, back in 2005, the commissioner of baseball actually threatened me. I was in the middle of an interview with him, and he said, do you really want to write about this? Think about your career. And I'm thinking, think about my career. Are you threatening me? When I worked on Shutout, same thing. Well, if you write about race in Boston, you know, no one's going to talk to you. Here's what really happens. For all these people who tell you that doing this is going to destroy you, there's this other subset of people who have been waiting for you and who say it's about time. And that's the same thing that has happened with this book. It has happened for the 16 years that I've been writing books now. Every time you take on one of these subjects, there's this huge number of people who have been waiting for you as a journalist to do your job, which is to hold people accountable and to tell people what's happening because you're the one who's got the access to it. And so I feel, I can't speak for Colin Kaepernick, obviously, because Colin Kaepernick has got to make his own decisions about what he felt was important and if his whatever number of millions of dollars he's lost over the past season for not playing was worth what he's done. I can certainly say in the eyes of the people who needed him to speak for them, they appreciate it, and it was certainly worth it for them. And I think he probably recognizes that, too, if I had to guess.
And I must admit, I was filled with such delight when LeBron James, who's done it repeatedly, but when he refused and with his teammates to stay in the Trump Hotel in Soho in Manhattan. And
Mimi, that's the game
and
right
Steph
now.
Steph Curry and, you know, et cetera.
Oh, well, that's the game right now. This is where it is. When you start to look at the next wave of where we are, what you're really seeing is it's not simply your opinion versus my opinion. It's an aggression on the part of these sports leagues because they have decided, certainly post 9/11, to embed this authoritarian narrative of flags and flyovers and police and patriotism into the game day experience. And for anyone who challenges that game day experience, whether you're Colin Kaepernick or Eric Reid of the 49ers or any of them, LeBron James, despite his power, they're going to try to undermine you, and the way they're doing it is to take your money. They're going to find a way to hurt you and take your employment, and that's one of the very difficult things that we're seeing now is you have a president who is essentially threatening your livelihood for what you think is right. Mm. He's making this deal even more difficult than it's always been in the past. And I think we talked about this earlier. You mentioned the Minnesota Lynx, and it's one of the areas where I felt
And I have
more
to say that we have about 30 seconds.
30 seconds, I'll be fast.
Of course.
There should have been more women in the book, Mimi. Let's put it that way. And one of the things in the book that I didn't get in there because I hadn't thought of it, and I wish my female friends had read my manuscript, is that you have to remember that female athletes, their money doesn't come from team sports. It comes from individual sports, which means they're going after their endorsements. So women are even more at risk than the men.
That's the next book, Howard.
It sure is.
It's delightful to speak to you. It truly is. And this is the book. And actually, David Zarin said it. This is the book for explaining our times, whether you give a damn about sports or not. And how could you not? But it really, really does. And you're a great writer as well as a superb sportscaster. Take that, ESPN. You damn well should be promoting this book left and right. But we're all going to read it. And who knows? We're going to push for a couple of Pulitzers there. Why not? Howard Bryan, thank you for your courage, your convictions, your decency, and being the whole person and standing up for democracy and truth. The Heritage, Black Athletes, A Divided America, and the Politics of Patriotism is a book that must be on your list. Thanks, Howard. It's been a pleasure.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you.
This has been Building Bridges, your community and labor report with Mimi Rosenberg.
And Ken Nash. And log on to our website at www.buildingbridgesradio.org.